Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. This is episode 18 and our film for this week is Prophecy, released in 1979, directed by John Frankenheimer and starring this week's Coppola Connection, Talia Shire. If you have never listened to the podcast before, what we do here is we watch every single film in the collective Coppola filmography to determine whether they are the greatest film family of all time. This week, I'm joined by Will Chichester, where we kind of get under the skin of this creature feature and talk about his Coppola credentials, how he got to know the family as the wider organism. We also dive into the whole, like, creature feature phenomenon of the kind of mid to late 70s and how this film slots into films like Jaws or Piranha. If you haven't seen this film, we talk about it in every single gory, spoiler-filled detail. So be sure to stop the podcast now and go watch it. A little recommendation as well. This film has recently had a fantastic restoration by Eureka Entertainment. So pick up a Blu-ray. That's what I watched it on, and it's absolutely fantastic. Unfortunately for this episode, there is no bonus Nick Cage-filled chat, which I'm kind of a bit upset about. I feel like there would have been a great little chat with Will all about Nick Cage. But I'll be sure to get him on at some point to record a special Patreon bonus for that. But if you would like any of the previous Patreon episodes, head on over to patreon.com/cagedinpod, where you can donate as little as £1 or $1 a month to help this train keep chugging on down the track to Coppola Town. So I guess all that's left to do is to pack up your things, head on down to the woods, insert yourself in the middle of a tense situation involving some native people and some loggers, and be aware of the big old pizza bear as we make some Coppola connections. Today, I'm going down to the woods, and I'm sure I'm going to be in for a surprise, as we look at John Frankenheimer's 1979 eco-horror creature feature, Prophecy, written by the Omen's very own David Seltzer, starring Robert Foxworth, Amanda Sante, and today's Coppola connection, Talia Shire. To help me figure out what is going on in the woods, has somebody poisoned the waterhole, and what the fuck is that mutant bear? Is Will Chichester. Welcome, Will. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's so let's jump off the bat here, and I'll ask you what is your kind of history in regards to the ecological kind of creature features? Are you a fan?
Yeah, Jaws is one of my favorite films, and I think that was a jumping off point for quite a few of these. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I think, yeah, you had Jaws, and then obviously this is a bit later, but then Piranha, which is a classic. But yeah, so I'm a bit of a sucker for a creature feature. So yeah.
What about like films that kind of have this, like, I don't know, not message movies as such, but obviously this kind of, this film, and we'll get into it a lot more, has a very clear, like, we're the problem.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, like you said, I'm sure we'll get into it, but it packs in quite a few issues in the first 10 minutes.
Yes. So before we get to talking about Prophecy, I always like to ask people their kind of Coppola credentials. So when did you first become aware of the Coppola family as this entity that they are, of like, kind of, there's all these tendrils and all these different members of the family?
Well, I knew from Loving Films from younger, I knew the connection with Nicolas Cage and the Coppola family, and then Sofia Coppola, because but I wasn't aware of how far reaching it was, mainly through yourself, like how far reaching and how many there are and how many connections.
So who would have been your entry point? Like which family member's film would you have seen first?
Weirdly, I think it may have been Talia Shire because of the Rocky films.
Yeah.
Do you mean, because that would be, I think the first one I would have seen would have been Rocky IV. Mm-hmm. I remember Rocky IV because I'm 40 next year. I think Rocky IV was 86. Mm-hmm. So it was a few years after that. So I think, Rocky IV would have been, but I also remember watching The Godfather way too young.
Yep.
But because, I like films, therefore I have to watch The Godfather. Yeah, so probably Talia Shire would have been my entry point into the Coppolas without realising it, but yeah.
When did you become aware that she was a member of the Coppola family, would you say?
Only recently, to be honest. Yeah, fairly recently. But like, this is only through listening to yourself and, I wasn't aware until recently.
It's crazy, right? Because like, when you look back, you go, oh, it makes sense. That's why she's in The Godfather. Do you know what I mean? Amazing. So, I think you've answered the second question, which should have been, what would have been the first Talia Shire film you would have saw? And it would have been Rocky IV, right? So,
you would think Rocky IV.
Did she make an impression on you in those films? Because I know, like, especially Rocky IV, she's almost like a different character to what you meet in the first Rocky, right?
Yeah, so Rocky IV would have been the first one I watched. But then, obviously, since then, I've, like everyone else, watched all the Rocky films. And she is great. And we'll get into it. But she's pretty good in the film we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's good. But yeah, like, her character does change. But yeah, that the Rocky series is what I know of her, in the main part.
Yeah. What I like about the character of Adrian in the Rocky series is that, like, she kind of, like, comes out of herself as the films go on. Like, so I think, like, by that one, like, or the fifth one, at least, she's really, like, taking no shit. She's standing up for Rocky, like, do you know what I mean? When, like, there's pressures to fight and stuff like that.
She becomes more of a character rather than just a service of the film in the first one.
Yeah.
She does become a written character. So she does develop.
So let's talk about Prophecy.
Rob?
Vic, what are you doing here?
Listen to me. This paper company, Pitney Mills Paper Company, bought the timber rights to 100,000 acres of forest in Maine. The Indians claim the land is theirs.
I'm a doctor.
And you know how to deal with human beings. The Indians are angry, and so is the lumber company. Everybody's ready to kill each other.
People start disappearing. The Indians spread the word that they were taken by Katahdin. That's one of their legends.
I'm here to study the environment.
My people are violently ill, and this has nothing to do with alcohol. My people are fishermen. Their lives are clean.
I've seen children born dead. Born deformed.
The end of this forest is the end of my people.
Is that from Mercury?
It was created by man. And it will mindlessly, mercilessly kill every living thing it meets. Prophecy.
When did you first become aware of this film? We talked off mic. It'd be great to share your confusion when it came to picking this film off the list I sent you.
Yeah, I had a recollection of watching a film, Prophecy, and I knew in the back of my brain I'd seen the film Prophecy, but it wasn't this Prophecy. It was The Prophecy with Christopher Walken, which is a very different film.
Yeah, so kind of like harbinger of the end of the world, like post-apocalyptic movie, right?
Yeah, not this film.
No. So when did you first see this film?
About 3 days ago.
Amazing.
first time watch. Yeah.
Were you a John Frankenheimer fan before?
Yeah, because funny enough, I bought Seconds, the film Seconds, recently on Blu-ray because it'd been recommended quite a bit. So I watched that, and then I looked at John Frankenheimer, and it's surprising how many John Frankenheimer films I knew. His filmography is patchy. But he has made some great films.
What's interesting about this one is the fact that they, like, it is almost that John Frankenheimer felt like he needed to make a hit, and like they like pulled in David Seltzer, who had written The Omen. It's like kind of like, oh, that was a big hit, let's get that guy to write us a film. And then just kind of like, I want to do a creature feature as well. Can you write a creature feature, mate?
But also, I read that it was, because it came out the same year as Alien. Mm. And I was reading that there was a few critics who were saying it was going to trounce Alien at the box office. This was a potential franchise starter, which obviously didn't happen.
Well, yeah, they had the moxie to try and tease it as well with the ending we get.
Yeah.
So before we get too deep down talking about it, I always like to put people on the spot and ask them to kind of give a brief synopsis of what happens in this movie.
Okay. Well, it's a husband and wife. Well, there's a logger company which their waste may be mutating creatures. So the husband and wife tend to look into it as such. This, that's the gist of it. With Native Americans and some issue subplots.
Yeah, so what one of the things that like confused me straight off the bat with this, and I think like Robert Foxworth's character perfectly like kind of sums it up for the audience as well. When that guy approaches him, because obviously he's like this on-call doctor who kind of deals with like kind of people who are in like dire straits and stuff like that. And you get that scene early on where he's like out in like the tenements, do you know what I mean? Like attended to just like a rat bite. And it's like fucking like, you get that sense that like, oh, fucking like, he's dealing with some shit. And then, a big question I have is, how did that guy know he was going to be there? Like, do you know what I mean? Yeah.
There's that first 10 minutes try to pack in a lot of subplots, and there's a lot of exposition, like the whole Talia Shire thing. The opening, really liked. Mm-hmm. It was good. And then Talia Shire is introduced, and then they have the exposition. But yeah, I don't know how we knew he was there. The rap bite scene was odd.
So to the point of that, like, the actual intro to this film, as you said, is great. It's this, like, it's like a search team kind of like fumbling about in the woods, trying to look for these lumberjacks that have gone missing, right? And then, like, you get that kind of them abseiling down into that ravine, and then like
we dog off a cliff.
Yeah, and I think if I remember this correctly, you get like the sounds that there is something potentially there, and you get like the reveal of the bodies on the rocks, and it's all like gruesome. Yeah.
The dog goes off the cliff first. Yeah. Dog goes off the cliff, then they follow, and you do have that. You have that close-in scream, and then the orchestral, that was a bit of a weird choice. The orchestral music over the bodies, which was quite gruesome as well. It was quite, and then you realise why the orchestral music is, because we're going to be introduced to Talia Shire.
Yeah, and you talk about like exposition dumps, like her introduction to this, it's very like full on straight away, because it's like
it kind of took me aback how full on and such an exposition that it was on stage at an orchestra.
Well, yeah, they're kind of packing up, and her colleague kind of turns around to her, like cellist number two, and turns around and goes, "He can't force you to have an abortion." And it's like, what? This is the first line dialogue we're having in this creature feature.
First proper dialogue was, he can't force you to have an abortion. And she says, well, he's very busy all the time. And you think, oh, he's a busy man. Yeah. So, yeah, straight away, we're talking abortions.
Yeah.
So,
And it's probably best that it happens at the beginning of this film, because we don't have to dwell on it and have an awkward conversation ourselves about it. But it's a very jarring intro.
Yeah, definitely. And it is jarring But then also the following scene is quite, there's a lot in those 10 minutes. We go from that to, I'm not sure if this is like the Indians, as they keep getting referred to, or the OPs.
Yep.
And then we go to the ghetto. That's what it's described, the ghetto. It's a lot.
Yeah.
In the opening.
So I've got a clip from the ghetto section when, Rob, I believe his character's name's Rob as well. It's Rob and Maggie, isn't it? The couple. When this kind of company stooge comes to chat to him, and you get this great thing that Robert Foxworth does perfectly in this, is just like he plays like annoyed really well. And I just wanted to play this clip that really captures that. I think that's most of the clips I've got, actually. It's just every time that Robert Foxworth is outraged at something. But check this one out.
Now, I'll write a report here. No one will read. I'll file a lawsuit against a landlord that'll be settled out of court. Send that baby to the hospital for a couple of days so he can come back here and be eaten by rats again. I feel like I'm banging my head up against a wall. I don't think anybody's listening.
You want to know something? If I could have planned your side of this conversation, I couldn't have done it better.
So that's when we kind of get this proposition, and we get another exposition dump that the natives and the timber company are kind of at, pun intended, loggerheads as to what to do about the situation that's going on in the woods, right?
Yeah. And then obviously we head off to the woods and the paper mill, which all happens really quickly. It happens. There's not much discussion between. It happens. She takes her cello with her, I don't know why, but she does. She takes a check. And yeah, you meet the boss of the, who I can't think of, from The Thing.
Yes, right, isn't it? It is. It's Dysart. That's his name. I've got his name written down right here. Yeah, I know the guy you talk about. Yeah. It is your man from The Thing.
He's your man who's running the paper mill.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are really quickly there. And then we start. Yeah.
One of the scenes we get as well, and it's another, like, so we get introduced to the, like, native people, and they're kind of like, quote unquote, leader is John Hawks, like, played by Armand Asante, who is, for all intents and purposes, a very, like, European, like, Mediterranean looking man.
Yeah, that whole, yeah, it's quite, it was quite, from that moment with the OPs, and they keep referring to him as Indian, and he's obviously not Native American. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, when we meet them again, a lot happens in that scene.
So I've got that scene. If it's the one you're talking about, this.
Don't let this happen. Are you going to stand aside, Hawk? I'm going to tell you right now. You cut my head off before you cut these trees. Oh, come on. Take him down.
And we kind of get a glimpse there into Leonard Rosenman's score as well. Like the kind of like that is kind of frantically going like wee, wee, all the time and stuff like that. Like kind of really ramping up the tension. But let's discuss this a bit. What do you think of the portrayal of native people in this film?
It's difficult because it's, as you say, he's obviously not Native American, but actually, as it goes on, the portrayal is. I was worried when I first saw it. I thought, "Oh, this is going to be bad." But I think, yeah, it's not. It's okay. But I was concerned, especially given that first the exposition dumps at the beginning with the ghetto scene, which is pretty bad. I think we can say that's pretty bad. Then there was concerns it was going to be problematic.
Yeah, I think the plot is very sympathetic to the native people, and like,
yeah,
it doesn't fall into the traps of having like a magical native people or anything like that. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like,
I lined up at the cross and with the chair, I thought, this is where we're going to go. I thought we were going to have the whole mystic thing, but it didn't. It was, like you say, it was pretty sympathetic.
Yeah, yeah. And it, well, very much, you quickly learn as well that we are, like, on the side of, like, Robert Foxworth and Talia Shire and the native people, and it is kind of like this film very much shows as is still the case now, that the white man is the devil.
Absolutely. Yeah, we learn that. That's one thing. That scene sets that up with the chainsaw. Mm-hmm. I did worry there was going to be an axe chain. Not worry, I would have been all for it. An axe chainsaw battle, which didn't happen. But we quickly learn which side we're on.
One of the things we get around the time when they're in, like, at the woods, is they're introduced to Chekhov's family who are going camping as well. Like, you know immediately when that kid's like, "We're going camping. We're gonna sleep out in the woods." It's like, you're going to die.
Yeah, and the dad does that. There's that moment where the dad stops,
mm-hmm,
and looks. There's something wrong with these woods.
Yeah,
don't go back though. Let's keep going. So we know. They were, we all know why they were there.
Well, we get a few like misdirections as well, because we get that moment with John Hawks when he's like, so like Rob had like caught that like ridiculously big fish for dinner and they're cooking.
That salmon jumping is awful. When I saw the salmon jump, the big salmon, I thought, if this is the effects we have to come, this is going to be an absolute treat. And it didn't prove me wrong.
Well, they're like, yeah, because in that moment, like when they're outside, like, yeah, you get that shot of John Hawks outside of the cabin, kind of like staring very like mysteriously. Yeah. And like, again, with like the film's like leading you to be like, oh, is he potentially like in cahoots with Katahdin? Do you know what I mean? Like, is this thing of like, do they summon Katahdin to do their bidding or something like that?
You get that sense because, like you say, the score brings that in as well.
Yeah.
There's a mystery, but yeah.
So one of the key scenes I love in this is when Rob and Maggie go to the paper mill, and like he's like Rob's asking questions to like the kind of foreman about what is actually going into the water. Check this out.
Your question. Well, I'm answering your question. You're responsible for whatever effluent goes out of this plant. You hire the contractors, you sell the product, you're accountable for whatever goes on here.
How many pages in this report you're going to write?
I ask you a question.
Now, let me ask you a question. How many pages? 100? How many copies? 1,000, maybe?
I want to know what chemicals you're using.
We're talking about 100,000 pieces of paper just for your report. Am I far off? Huh? And how many sheets of paper are those other filing cabinets in Washington?
You're not answering me.
I am answering you. Now, I supply, but you demand. You're responsible, too. Now, unless you want to start filling your filing cabinets with rocks and wiping your nose with cactus...
I want to know what you soaked the logs in. What chemical?
None.
I don't believe that.
Well, then you take water samples. That's what we do. Yes, sir. Now, look. If those logs were soaked in chemicals, it would squeeze out in the pumping process right under the watershed in front of this plant. Now, we test that water every 10 days, and there's not a damn thing floating out there that we don't know about, or anything that's harmful to the environment. Now, excuse me, Mrs. Byrne. Go on, go test the water. We got nothing to hide.
This feels like a perfect time to talk about Robert Foxworth. What do you make of his performance in this film?
I really liked him. I think he was channeling some Kurt Russell The Thing energy.
Yeah.
He had that vibe about him.
Kurt Russell as well. Maybe Kurt Russell was channeling Robert Foxworth.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. So, yeah, I liked him. I thought him and Tyler Shaw were good. Yeah, I really liked him, especially when he was, like the clip we've just heard, when he was angry.
Yeah.
When he was angry. I
love his kind of like man on a mission, like kind of like, I don't know, because he's kind of caught between two fawns, isn't he? Because he's like,
yeah.
He's just trying to find the truth, and he's like a man, like, and it alludes a bit to that kind of 70s vibe of like, I don't know, stuff like, it's not a 70s movie, but like Blowout, or even like The Conversation, where there's like a conspiracy, like afoot, and somebody's like, I just want some goddamn answers. Like, that's the kind of like energy that Robert Foxworth brings to it.
You had that bit again with the rat bite scene, where it was kind of introduced that he may be a doctor, but he could be a badass.
Yeah.
Because he said, she said, maybe I put him in the hospital. And then he said, I'd like to put him in the hospital too. He's got a badass side.
Yeah, it'll fucking write you a prescription, but it'll also put you in a headlock if you give him any shit. Yeah, yeah. I got a lot of time for Robert Foxworth in this film. So you mentioned the effects as well, and the massive salmon. I guess we need to talk about the massive tadpole, right? What did you make of that reveal?
Tadpole, which they even refer to as. It's a tadpole. I think they do say it's massive.
It's big.
Then we really know that things are going wrong in the woods. The massive tadpole's a strange choice as well.
Yeah.
A massive tadpole.
I don't quite understand the logic that, like, some things just get massive and other things go fucking cuckoo bananas. Do you know what I mean? Like,
salmon go massive. Some things go, like you say, mutated. Which will get ugly, like awful looking. Yeah, but the salmon was just massive and the tadpole was just massive.
Yeah.
But I assume if the tadpole was massive, the frogs are going to be huge.
Yeah, that's a trick they've missed there.
I would have liked, that's a big tadpole. Check out the fucking massive frog. The frog. Yeah.
So that's when we're like introduced to the like we get introduced to like more of the like native people. So we have like Ramona played by Victoria Racimo, and we get the older gentleman as well, who's kind of like, he seems to know. Like, that's the vibe you get from him. He's like, ah, let me tell you about Katahdin.
That's the slipping into the like the mystic natives, where he is the elder. They refer to him as the elder, and he knows of the myth of Katahdin. Yeah,
Katahdin. I think it is Katahdin. Yeah, unless I've got that completely wrong. So when they obviously, after the paper mill, we get the moment where like Rob starts to realize what the fuck could be going on.
I believe him.
Why?
Why would he have offered to let you test the water?
Maybe it wasn't in the water.
Huh?
Maybe it's heavier than water. That silvery stuff on your boot. Is it dry?
Yes.
They gave us a trick question in medical school. What's the only liquid in the world that isn't wet?
What was the answer?
Mercury.
So anyone listening to this, the way that scene is played out as well, so obviously you heard the like music swelling, it might as well be that Robert Foxworth just like kind of like has his head arched down, and as he delivers that line, like looks up towards camera like, the shit has hit the fan, everybody. It's like, that's the big moment, right? When you're like, fuck.
Yeah. Mercury.
Yeah.
It's a big degree of mercury. Have we, at this point of the, has the raccoon been involved?
The raccoon has been involved, yeah. So we got the kind of like,
which, yeah. That was one of my favorite things in the film. Like, again, it, the logic behind it, because that was just a raccoon.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a giant raccoon, a mutated raccoon. It was just an angry raccoon.
Yeah.
Ended up being killed with an oar and a fire. But yeah, because that set that. He wants the raccoon. Am I right in thinking he wants the raccoon tested?
Well, yeah, he kind of wants to test everything, doesn't he? Like now he's like hell bent on testing the water once he realizes the mercury, like there's mercury in there. And I don't know about you, but like, is mercury a mutagen? Like that they kind of talk about.
I don't know my science very well, but I was a bit when he said like, mercury. I was like, mercury? Oh, I know it's not good, but like, I don't remember it ever being a thing. Yeah. They mutate things. Does it? I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I remember, I don't like mercury. Don't put a thermometer in your mouth, the mercury, because in school, if it breaks, it'll be bad for you.
Yeah.
I don't think it would turn into a giant tadpole. I don't remember. Yeah, that's all. I don't remember. Yeah, I don't think it's a. I don't remember it being a mutating.
When we get that, like reveal that there is like a mutagen in the water, like it obviously like, and what it's doing to everything, it brings about possibly one of the most like devastating revelations you could get in a film, and it's perfectly conveyed on Talia Shire's face, because she knows she's pregnant, he doesn't know she's pregnant, and we know she's pregnant, and it is just like your stomach falls out the bottom of your ass.
Yeah, and by now she's eaten the salmon.
Yeah,
the salmon, because there's that conversation, yeah, about, you know, it's in the fish, and. She is this the point they have the conversation where she says,
how much fish would you have to eat to
yeah, and he's only a small amount, and you're like, ah, no, I thought that's where, for a while I thought, because the tadpole's giant, I thought, here we go, this is gonna be a thing, but there's a bear instead.
We're gonna be jumping about here, but like, I kind of want to just pull the thread on the, like, baby subplot. Because I feel like it's something that just... Well, it's not resolved, right?
No, at all. To me, it felt like maybe that was something that was... Whether it was in the script, which was made more of... Because I constantly thought we'd had the, you know... It was hinted at that... It was going to be a big thing.
Yeah.
I thought maybe the, I don't know whether she accelerate the birth and she's going to, I don't know, a giant tadpole. I don't know. But I thought there was going to be more something, but it doesn't really come to anything. We never know.
Yeah. And it poses a very like interesting moral conundrum. Like, and it kind of like, it's almost becomes a message movie on the idea, I don't know, of abortion and that kind, you know, like, where very progressive for its time, you know, like when people like now they can, this is very, very different because like it is potentially like a mutant, like, no, and I'm not talking about like,
no, potentially a giant tadpole.
Yeah. Or so, like, yeah. And yeah, and it's not like, it's not going to be like, I'm going to go to Professor Xavier's school.
We're not going X-Men.
Yeah. But like, it poses that thing of, you know, like when people can do tests to find out, like, is their kid going to be born with any disabilities and stuff like that. It kind of like flirts with that idea and like quite progressive for 1979. But then, and it sets up, as you said, like the first bit of dialogue we get is all about the pregnancy, and then like it just leaves you empty at the end, because it's like, why didn't you like resolve this?
Yeah, that's why I absolutely thought, that's why I absolutely thought that, because it was our first bit of dialogue, first bit of like exposition, and like we know it's going to be an issues. They're going to deal with issues, because you kind of get that sense from that conversation. Like you say, it doesn't really come to anything. Whether it's just be an added bit of tension and threat, but I got the feeling there may have been, or potentially would have been more of that, that kind of just didn't happen. Even the original poster, which I say, the prophecy is like a bear kind of thing. And it looks like it's in like an egg or, do you know what I mean? So I wasn't sure if that was, it's gone, been swept aside, and they've just gone, well, actually, no, let's focus on the bear.
Well, because we get like, so yeah, to kind of like break it down into a few scenes that kind of deal with it, we get the reveal later on in the film when she kind of says to him, like, but I'm pregnant, do you know what I mean? Like, and the way he handles it is fucking terrible, considering he's like supposed to be, he's like portrayed to be this empathetic guy. He like, he suggests to kill it, right? He's like, his suggestions, well, we've got to kill it, Maggie. And it's like, And then that is genuinely the last we ever hear of the baby. And when you get that, when we got that like scene right at the end, which again feels massively redundant when she's in a hospital bed, I thought there would be some, like, I'm not sure. How did you read that kind of moment?
Yeah, I was thinking there was going to be a tease for a sequel, or we were going to have something, because like you say, that is it. That conversation regarding that is pretty much it until the hospital bed. And like, I was half expecting maybe, you know, the David Cronenberg with the fly, the dream sequence. Mm-hmm. Maybe something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, it just doesn't come to anything.
Yeah, or like, I don't know. I don't know if there was like a few added seconds where like he like mentions like, do you know what I mean? The doctor said it's not like you lot, like it's not good or whatever, or I don't know, some kind of like full stop on it. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It turns out you weren't pregnant. Like, it was all like, wait, you're all right.
Some kind of closure to that storyline thread. But it is, because I know there was a lot of cuts to bring it down, because apparently I read that Frankenheimer blamed a lot of the failings of the film on his alcohol intake at the time. I think he was heavily in drink, but also there is always, it was heavily cut, and to bring it down to it, I'm not sure the rating, but I wonder whether some of those cuts were part of that.
Yeah.
So that's, I lost. Because I mean, there's cuts that could have been made rather than that.
Like, yeah, well, it's got a very saggy middle, right? Like, so
the I know we're jumping about, but the, because we do need to get to the bear, but the that scene is in the tunnel.
Yes, yeah,
is incredibly strange. It takes way too long, and there are so many close-ups of eyes.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like it was a scene that was put into a film to make it longer, but we know it's not a short film and it was already cut. It's just a really weird moment, that is. Because it almost plays like something from like Garth Marenghi's Dark Place.
Yeah.
It goes too long. It just becomes funny, then not funny, then funny again. And then you go, actually, what is going on here? Because it's constantly on the close-ups of eyes.
Yeah, the thing is, after that moment as well, like, it's kind of them just on a mad scramble to try and like get out of there. That's when it kind of sags, and it's only in like literally the last 5 minutes after that that it kind of ramps back up again. But obviously, before that, we get it's what, like close to an hour, the hour mark, when we even get introduced to the monster of the whole movie.
58 minutes. 58 minutes before we're introduced to the creature. But I mean, as introductions go, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Have the honors. Tell us about this absolutely scene stealing performance that we get.
Well, Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. The creature, we finally see the creature, which is a bear-like creature. It looks more like a giant one of those skinless cats.
Yeah.
It looks like one of those giant skinless cats, as I don't know, fuck the giant pepper army. It's a real mess. And then it attacks the family we've seen earlier, which we kind of knew they were going to be in trouble.
Cannon fodder.
Yeah, they were absolute fodder. And then one of the children, I think it's the boy, is it?
Yeah,
the boy, zipped up, just his face poking out of his nice little yellow sleeping bag. And what a choice to have him try and hop away. Hop away, and then our big pepper army man, Bear, slaps him so he spins and hits a rock and just explodes in feathers. It's glorious. I've watched that since I watched the DVD. Watched the film yesterday. I've watched that scene, I would say, 10 times.
It's fantastic. And yeah, you mentioned the Pepper Army monster. They referred to it. I know that Tom McLaughlin, one of the performers, who's like a mime, who was one of three performers who was inside like one of the bear costumes they had.
Because one was the Predator, wasn't it? The man who was in the is that right?
Yeah, so Kevin Peter Hall would do like any of the shots that were the full-size creature, because I think he was like this hulking, like, 7'1" guy. And then on top of that, they put like him on stilts as well, so like the bear would be massive. But then for like one of the like suits that was more close up, they had this mime guy, like, yeah, Tom McLaughlin, yeah, was a mime, so he could get the physicality of it. But like, even then, you've got these like great talents. Do you know what I mean? Like Kevin Peter Hall, like, is fantastic in Predator. He's fantastic in Harry and the Hendersons as well. He played Harry in that. Like, and you get that like great physical performance. Whereas in this, it looks like they're just constricted under this like suit.
I don't think it would be unfair to say that the Bear Pepper Army is shit.
They referred to it as the Pizza Bear because they said it looked like a melted pizza, like, you know, kind of like, yeah, like,
mate, perfect. I mean, yeah, like I said, it's real lumbering, and there's no movement to it. It's a choice.
So let's name and shame the effects artist on this. That is Tom Berman is the effects artist on this, who would go on to do some interesting stuff, which we'll get into a bit later. But like, yeah, like the creature, and I know it isn't their original idea, because they wanted to lean a lot more into the Katahdin thing, because the description we get from like the elder gentleman is like,
We get the description, don't we?
Yeah, where it's like,
not what we see.
Yes. Yeah. So the description is like, it's a lot more like a hybrid of different animals, or like, have like the gills of a fish and this.
Yeah, and a dragon is the size of a dragon. Size of a dragon. Yeah, and it like you say, it's a hybrid of creatures, and there's obviously mythical creatures as well. The decision to what we ended up with is odd.
Yeah, it looks like a kind of, it just looks like a bear that half of it's like been like melted. That's it.
Yeah, it moves and looks like a melting waxwork of a bear.
Or like an animatronic from Disneyland is like malfunctioned and caught on fire.
Been in an awful fire. Yeah, kind of, and it moves like you could outrun it.
Yeah,
because it don't move very quick. It lumbers. It can't turn. Its neck doesn't work. Yeah, it's rubbish. Unfortunately.
Oh, you mentioned
why we didn't see it for an hour. Mm-hmm. Maybe we were, and but then saying that, you do see. If they had had the feeling that maybe it wasn't the greatest, we do see it a lot then.
Yeah.
We do, in the last 40 minutes, we see a lot of it.
I think the choice to hold it back is more of that thing of taking cue from Jaws, isn't it? Where it's like, tease the audience with like, something's out there, but like, we're not entirely sure. Do you know what I mean? We're not gonna blow our load and let you know straight off the bat. Like,
yeah, because the opening is very Jaws,
mm-hmm.
Almost cold opening with the. It's really similar to the opening of Jaws.
Yeah.
So yeah, that holding it back, but then Spielberg did have the sense to, even when we do reveal it, to like maybe not show it so much. Because, tell me, like the Katahdin, the bear, the pizza bear, coming through the water and stuff, it really looks bad. But then, like, the idea that some people were championing and thinking it was going to be, you know, it was going to batter Alien at the box office. This was going to be a, I mean, what did they, what were they going to do with that creature?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause like, so you've mentioned about it, like battering Alien at the box office. So the budget for this, well, it washed its face. So the budget was $12 million. And it grossed $22.7 million, but I guess with like budget, like with marketing and stuff like that, that's probably like, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, it's not.
It's not great. Do you know? It's not a runaway success that Alien was.
No, not at all. Because the title was The Prophecy, the monster movie.
Yeah,
and then because it's not the monster movie.
It's a monster movie.
Definitely. No, it's not the monster movie. Quite a long shot.
So one of the things they find, it gets like, there's some choices made in this, like both on story and by characters that I am confounded by. One of them is when they find, I guess, what would be like a baby mutant bear.
Oh. Yeah.
In the water, and they decide what's the best idea is we're now going to look after this and try and get blood samples.
Yeah, because they find two. Don't, yeah. There's one dead, and Talia Shire says, there's one alive. One's alive. So, yeah, they decide to take a blood sample. But that again, I wonder if there was more to that, because there's that scene where she's, when they're in the tunnels again, she's cradling it like a baby. She's almost looking after it then.
Yeah.
Which is odd, because then it randomly decides to eat her neck. But yeah, I think there was possibly, there was more to the parental story. Because it was hints of it, like that whole thing of taking the baby pizza bear. And they end up sort of looking after it because they do want blood samples, but then they keep it alive, and it makes that absolutely horrendous noise, which it genuinely was quite creepy. The only creepy thing in the film was
that kind of like, it was I haven't got a
yeah,
clip of it.
Horrible.
But
again, I think that hinted at, because it was a baby, and I was assuming from that we were going to have more of the pregnancy thing, but we didn't.
Yeah, it's bizarre. Like, so what about the kills in this film? Is it satisfying on that level that we get some good kills? Obviously, we've talked about the absolute pinnacle of kills, but like the other kills we get in it.
Once you reach that height of the sleeping bag kill, it's difficult to come. The sleeping bag kill is so, well, I say good.
It's memorable, at least, do you know what I mean? You're going to be like...
It's great, because I'm absolutely going to watch it again. And I'm going to say to people, you've got to see this. Because, I'm sorry to go back on it again, but it's the flip of the sleeping bag. It completely spins.
Yeah.
And spins it off. And doesn't like smack in a gory way. It goes... in feathers. Absolutely. What a choice. But yeah, rest of the kills. Yeah, they're decent. I mean, towards the end, when it all starts really kicking off with Pizza Bear, I think it was probably more gory.
Mm-hmm.
I think by reading things, they went for that. They were kind of pushed in the direction of the Jaws model, where they wanted to. Which was going to, you know, for all markets. So I think it probably was more. Because weirdly, the beginning those bodies and stuff sets up a real gory film.
Yeah.
Cause that's quite graphic with them. He's smashed against the rocks and his eyes hanging out. And you think, oh it's good. But it doesn't really until the end.
Yeah.
So it's slack. And yeah, there's a lot of clawing and things, but not full on.
Even when we get Richard Dysart's like death, when he's like trying to get underneath that fence, you know, like when there's like that, like just cuts, like you kind of get him, like the bear, the pizza bear's gonna get him, and then it's like, wah! And then like cuts to the other guys kind of just like far arsing around in the woods, just kind of like going, oh, we can't use the helicopter, and we're just gonna like kind of wander about for a day, and then like Hawk comes back and says, oh, I found this like all-terrain vehicle we can get to the nearest town in and stuff like that. Like, yeah,
there is one decent jump scare though.
Mm-hmm.
It's the all-terrain vehicle, because again, it misdirects you all, and then Pizza Bear comes, and it's a good jump. But that is the only. It's definitely not a scary film. That's the only jump. But like you say, the gore and it's really dialed back from that first.
Yeah,
and it is going to be a gory creature feature. Like I don't know, but yeah, it again. I think that's more of the cuts that were possibly made.
Well, it's obviously like. You can, like, now that you've mentioned the cut, you can see things where it's like there are gaping holes. And, like, obviously, this has got like a beautiful restoration by Eureka. Like, it looks like the new Blu-ray looks fantastic. It's just the thing of like, I imagine somewhere out there, there's some film canisters that have got like some of this missing footage, because you get like that moment when they're on like the shore and the elder kind of like just gives up basically to Katahdin. Yeah. He's kind of going, Katahdin, Katahdin. And I almost expected like a look between them, or a moment where like it seems like, and this probably would, where it would like teeter into the mystic native person territory, but like, almost like a fake out where it's like, oh, he's managed to like get to the humanity of the beast. And then it like, and then you get that like, no, actually, fuck you. Like, I'm going to kill you.
Because I absolutely thought that's where I was going.
Yeah.
Because there's that weird, like a split second where, like you said, that is happening. Because I thought because the bear stops doing the noise. It's like a silence. And I thought, oh, this is what's going to happen. But we don't see anything. And then we cut to them crossing the water. They look back and he's flailing about in the mouth.
Yeah. It's fucking crazy, isn't it? And then like, when they get to the other side of the water, it's just that thing. It really suffers from slasher victim-itis, in the fact of like, they get to the other side of the water on the jetty, like just about to get to the cabin, and they're just looking back at the beast, and it's like, get the fuck out of there. Don't fart ass around in the water.
She says, it's coming. Yeah. Oh, I mean, again, that bear, pizza bear, coming through the water is, and the size perspective keeps changing as well. Because how tall they swam. How tall is the bear now?
Yeah.
Into the water. But then it's at the moment they've gone, it's drowned. You feel like saying, oh, come on. You know it's not drowned, mate.
Yeah. it's that thing as well. There's a missed opportunity for something a lot more explosive, as opposed to just all of a sudden you just see blah, 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 a few bubbles on the top of the water. It's like, I expected that bear to just like smash through that jetty, grab one of them. Like, instead,
you expect like there's none of those. The one, but like that jump scare in with the all-terrain vehicle is more a music cue than a big jump. The beast jumping. There's I think that's down to the design of the creature, because I don't think it could do any of that. Because it lumbers about. I don't think there's a physicality, like you say, for that crashing through things. It just appears and maybe brushes some trees aside to get somewhere.
Well, you say that, but like when they like barricade themselves in the cabin, which we realize pretty quickly is futile, because all of a sudden, like the pizza bear like just rips the fucking roof off, and it's like, what the fuck? Like, how? And again, it's that thing of perspective. Like, how big is it? Like, because it's like lumbering over them.
Yeah, and like when he first sees the claws, it would be the slash marks. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it walks through this. Yeah, it's not good, is it?
Well, we'll get on to how we'll score this in a minute. But what do you make of this kind of final showdown that they have with Pizza Bear?
Parts of it are pretty good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, until the our hero doctor decides he proper stabs her in the eye. Lovely stuff. We have a real bit of gore then, because you get blood. Lovely. But I'm not sure why he decided to jump into the quite obviously the water and jump on the quite obviously rubber bear and then continue to stab it for quite a while. And it looks, again, it's quite obviously a rubbish dummy. I think there's some really weird choices of obviously of cuts or things they've decided to keep, because that looks real. The fight looks all right.
Yeah.
But then it's the after when he keeps stabbing in the water. It's terrible.
I love Hawk's death. Again, it's another like kind of very like considering like I don't know it's in like the last 2 minutes of the film, like. He's managed to get a few arrows off at it, and it's like that. You think, like, oh, maybe he's done a good job, and then again, he just gets like twatted the same way that kid in the sleeping bag does. And you see, like, again, like a dummy of him just like fling through the air, and then we get a close up of him looking all haggard.
Yeah, he's got slash marks on his face.
Yeah,
but like, I think that the slapping off it. Just slapping everyone so they fly through the air is possibly because I don't think that the creature or the design of the creature could fight in any way.
Yes.
So they just had to make do with it just slapping people into rocks. Yeah. The final showdown's all right. But I think it suffers from that. It suffers from the creature.
Mm-hmm.
And then the whole film, that whole final last 40 minutes suffers from the creature being so terrible.
Well, yeah, and I think that is what these films kind of win and lose on, right? If you're a creature feature, make the creature either good, like really good, or follow the Jaws model. Really, don't show it. And I think that's why that film has stood the test of time. And is kind of like revered as one of the best films of all time. Is that like Steven Spielberg had the foresight to be like, you know what? We've seen the animatronic shark. It looks shit. So let's figure out a way around it.
Yeah, yeah. And people are going to know it's a rubber shark. Like there wasn't a moment of threat of this pizza bear. Because I reckon one solid kick from behind, it would have fallen over. That's where it absolutely falls apart. Because there are bits which are, because John Frankenheimer can direct, like I say, he's got a patchy filmography, but he's an interesting director. Like I said about that second, it's a real interesting film, and he's done some interesting stuff, done some terrible stuff, but he can direct. But in that interview I read that he said, you know, he was deep in alcohol at that point, and whether that is a reason. There are shoddy choices, I don't know. But yeah, it just falls apart in that last hour because the creature is so terrible.
Mm-hmm.
That is where it falls apart.
Yeah, definitely.
Which is a shame because, yeah, like I say, they are. There's the seed of a good idea, yeah, of an interesting thing, and they keep hinting at these interesting things and may come to something that never do, and then we end up with shit bay.
And then, like, again, it kind of ends in like a very anticlimactic manner in the fact that he stabs the bear and then they're flown out of the woods. That's basically it, right?
Yeah, and but we get the tease.
Yes.
Of that. But we've got a tease of another shit bay.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. It's in broad daylight as well, isn't it? So it's like, yeah. There's no hiding it.
No. In broad daylight, doing like the noise. Yeah, and mind you, I say this, I would absolutely have watched the sequel.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
I'm not, it's the bay is terrible, but I had a good time with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd watch the sequel, even with the new shit bay.
So now we come to the point of the podcast where we rate the film. And the way we do it over here is by talking about the perfect wine pairing for the film, because those Coppolas, they bloody love their wine. So what, for you, Will, would be the perfect wine pairing for Prophecy?
Well, I was thinking the mid-range,
mm-hmm,
like a Merlot, because something that wants to be like full-bodied and classy, but actually it's a bit shit. You know, it's fine. While you're drinking it, it's all right. But then it's not what it wants to be.
Yeah, it gets the job done. I think that's very much what this film does.
It's fine. I've had the bottle. I could consider another one of them. But I'd happily also fall asleep and forget about it as well. But yeah, it's that kind of thing. You know, it's a mid-range. Nice label. Lovely label.
You've heard a lot of good things about the winery as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a good winery, that one. Yeah, have a go.
Oh, it won the an award. It's got a gold stamp on it. Lovely. We'll have it. It is what it is.
Perfect. So I think you've kind of answered that, but is it a bottom shelf, mid shelf, or top shelf wine?
I mean, I suppose it's mid shelf because I enjoyed it.
Yeah, that is the thing. Yep.
It's a mid shelf wine because I enjoyed it. I probably, if it was Friday night and I wanted a cheap fix, I'd probably buy it again. it was fine. But yeah, it's not terrible. It's not a terrible film.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Despite all my jibes at it and kind of like poking fun at it, there is a lot to still be enjoyed in it. I think like the Robert Foxworth performance, that kind of like
Charlie Shire's great in it.
Yeah, those two are great. And it's almost like that thing of, if it was just like a ecological political thriller, it would, like all of that element of it is fucking, do you know what I mean? If it was like that.
If it's a creature feature, that would be better without the creature.
Yeah. If this was given to like De Palma, do you know what I mean? And it was a bit more like, what the fuck is going on?
Well, funny you say De Palma then, because the bit in the tunnel I said about, that was quite De Palma-y anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, like, if it had been that the conspiracy they were trying to find out and it was the Mercury and we didn't have the frog spawn. Oh, no, sorry, the, control and the that stuff going on, yeah, it's the bits of it are really good. But unfortunately, it's a creature feature that falls apart as soon as the creature comes into it.
Yeah. Would you recommend people if they like? Obviously, we've spoiled it for them, but like, would you recommend people check it out?
Oh, fuck yeah! Yeah. Just even for the sleeping bag.
Yeah, definitely.
There's loads to enjoy in it. I liked it. I'll probably buy the Blu-ray.
Yeah, I'm gonna say this. I'm not a company stooge. I haven't been paid to say this, but like, I've got to say, and I'm just like really chuffed because it's the first company who I've contacted for like a press screening of a Blu-ray have sent it to me. But the Eureka release of this is great. Like, it's kind of like it's got some great interviews and like the picture and sound on the film looks fantastic.
Yeah, it looks great. I mean, I say about that tunnel scene, like the tunnel scene is odd, but the actual, it looks amazing. It really does. It's so clear and crisp. But yeah, the release is amazing. Because it's my, I love a B-movie creature feature. That's like I buy a lot of Arrow and I've got seconds on Eureka. So like, yeah, I'll buy it because I'll definitely watch it again.
Yeah, it's schlocky. Right.
Yeah, but it's one I could say to a few beers or and say, I've got a film. You've got to see the bear. You've got to see the sleeping bag. That kind of film. I'd absolutely recommend people because it's not. It does what it does and it does it fine. It's just a shame that the shit.
Well, that's perfect. Yeah, I think you summed it up perfectly there. Another thing we like to do on this podcast, where we wrap stuff up as well, is see if there was any Coppola connections. So, were there anyone who worked on the film who have worked with another Coppola family member somewhere down the line? Did you manage to find any, Will?
Well, no. Well, it's a connection of sorts. It's quite tenuous, but it does link up.
All right, so, yeah, I have it.
Yeah. So, John Frankenheimer.
Yep.
Right. Let's start. Francis Ford Coppola.
Yep.
Frankenheimer directed Brando in Island of Dr. Moreau, which was another creature feature, which is terrible. That's the connection I've made.
Perfect. I love it. I'll run through a few.
It's tenuous, but I'm having it.
I'll run through a few boring but like direct connections that I really had to dig for on this one. I really had to kind of look into the people who worked in like costume and do you know what I mean? Like stuff like that to find some links. The top one might be my favorite. Bob Ten Hoon was Carl Kovic in Wild at Heart, but his scenes were deleted. So I love that. He was in the film, but he's not in the film.
I kind of wish the tadpole was a Coppola. That would have been...
That would have been amazing. The editor of this, Tom Wolfe, was the editor of Windtalkers as well, the John Woo, Nicolas Cage film from 2002, I want to say. And then... Yeah, the set decorator worked on The Cotton Club, which was directed by Francis Ford Coppola, and All the President's Men, which was scored by David Shire. And then, let's run through the... Our man of the moment, your best mate, Tom Berman, the effects artist, worked on City of Angels as the makeup effects artist. Not that I don't really remember any makeup. Maybe, I don't know, make Cage look a bit more angel-like. And Con Air as well. He did the special makeup effects in Con Air. Again, I'm not really sure.
Maybe what's happening with him is they're saying, look, come on, you can be the makeup, but just don't do any makeup, mate. We'll give you a credit. Just put stuff away.
And yeah, he did some additional makeup work on The Godfather Part 3. So make of that what you will. Maybe old it up Al Pacino. Put that talcum powder in his hair.
I'd love it if they kept bringing him in and he constantly wants to put a pizza in everything. Mm-hmm. I'd like, not the pizza beer again, mate. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, let's round this out with me asking you some questions that I'm ever so glad that I'm asking instead of answering. The first one is, which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so, you get rid of the filmographies of the rest of the family?
I mean, there's a world without Apocalypse Now, Godfather. It's hard to, but it's Nicolas Cage, isn't it? Nicolas Cage. I mean, yeah, it's absolutely Nicolas Cage. I mean, that seems like a cop-out answer considering the podcast, but it's absolutely Nicolas Cage. I mean, I can't live in a world without Con Air, Face Off, and Wild at Heart. I just don't want to be in it.
I'm not going to say that's the right answer, but it's the right answer. I keep saying this in the podcast, but I love people who answer this question as selfishly as possible with what they want. I feel like, and this is no discredit to people who answer the question with, if I look at like the state of film, as it were, like, do you know what I mean? I think for other people, like, the world wouldn't be the same without Francis Ford Coppola. It's like, yeah, but that's no fun. I want to know what makes you tick.
Yeah, I want to watch. I want to watch Willy's Wonderland on a Friday.
Perfect. So, based off this film alone, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time?
No. Based on this film alone? No. I mean, that's a bit unfair because Talia Shire is good. She is good in it.
Mm-hmm.
But no.
She's fighting her case, but unfortunately she lost it.
Yeah. To a big pizza bear.
And possibly the most important question on this podcast is, what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
Well, I watched Lost in Translation again today.
Okay.
I did. And I hadn't seen it for a long time. And I'd like to think that the standard answer is he says something along the lines of, you know, you don't need me. But what struck me is she says a line about writing, about being a writer,
mm-hmm.
but she doesn't think she's any good. So I think he says to her, you can write to me. You don't need me, but you can write to me because you know you can write. I'd love that.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. I didn't know where that was going to go. I thought you were gearing up to do a rug pull and a big gag at the end.
No, I got to be honest. I wasn't sure where it was going because I just said that then. But going with it.
Amazing. That's a perfect answer. Well, thank you so much for coming and making some Coppola connections with me, Will. Where can people find you if they want to hassle you? If they disagree with your opinions on this film, where can they come and find you and tell you you're wrong?
I just Twitter. That's where I don't really do the others, but I'm just on Twitter at Will Chich. That's
perfect.
Where I'm at. If anyone wants to disagree with me about the pizza bear.
Well, again,
Or talk exploding sleeping bags. I'm fine with it.
Yes, please. Yeah. Please, if you're listening to this, guys, I beg of you to, I will pin it to my fucking top of my Twitter when you hear this, to just use the GIF that is there and just at will in it. Just send loads of that GIF. And I think it will make everyone's day
Absolutely.
A whole much brighter, right? It was like seeing that GIF over and over again. Well, Will, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here to make some Coppola connections with me.
Thank you very much.
And there we go. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to win Will around to the Coppolas being the greatest film family of all time. But there's still plenty of films to make up that tally chart to make it so I am right in the end, that I'm not wasting my time and that I am vindicated that they are the greatest cinematic family of all time, baby. And I will be doing so next week by talking to the fantastic David Trumbull all about Jason Schwartzman's first ever screen acting role in Wes Anderson's Rushmore. It's a fantastic chat. I've been sitting on this one for a while. I think you're really, really going to enjoy it. And be prepared. It's a long one. I think it's an hour longer than the actual film, but we get into some real deep places and kind of really bare our souls on this one. So, yeah, I think you're in for a treat. We go to some places that, I don't know, that you'll hopefully appreciate. And, yeah, it was a really fun chat, as much as there was, like, deep chat in there. It was a really fun chat, so be sure to check out that one next week. In the meantime, though, you can always keep up to date with everything I'm up to, whether that is on all the socials, so that is Instagram, Twitter, Letterboxd, and Facebook, all at Caged In Pod. And if you want to get in touch with the podcast, feel free to drop me a message on any of those, or drop me an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. As I said up front, you can always support the podcast on Patreon, which is patreon.com/cagedinpod. Or you can buy me a coffee, which is coffee.com/cagedinpod again. If you enjoyed this episode or any episode of the podcast, please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Acast, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this right now. It really does help to give me those nice rating and reviews. It helps me, like, get up the charts. I think the highest, like, I checked recently, it was like got to like number 24 in the film history charts on the Apple Podcast app, which is absolutely crazy. So if we can try and get it in the kind of top 10, let's do it, guys. Tell people, you know, who knows, their favorite film might be coming up. Who knows, this might be their favorite podcast. So let people know. Let's share the word. So as always, I've been Petros Patsilivas, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Podcharles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Droop Town Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.